Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, March 5th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, bringing interventional radiology, immunotherapy, and robot-assisted surgery to cancer care for the greater Saratoga community. SaratogaHospital.org for more information. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Tia Olds of New York Oncology Hematology. She's here to answer your questions about the shifting role of radiation therapy in treating metastatic cancer. We always get a lot of calls on this program, so get yours in now. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Radiation therapy, Dr. Tia Olds, your calls, and much more, all coming up on Vox Pop right after this news. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today for Medical Monday is Dr. Tia Olds of New York Oncology Hematology. Dr. Olds is board-certified radiation oncologist treating all types of cancers. Dr. Olds received her medical degree from the Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta, where she was valedictorian of her class. She completed her internship at St. Vincent's Medical Center on Staten Island and her residency in radiation oncology at SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse. A member of the American Society of Therapeutic Radiology and Oncology, Dr. Olds sees patients at NYOH's offices in Albany and Clifton Park. She's here today to answer your questions about the shifting role of radiation therapy in treating metastatic cancer. Dr. Olds, welcome to Medical Monday.
Afternoon, Alan. Thank you for having me.
You're making a triumphant re-return. You were last on about 3 years ago. Terrific to see you again. Okay, so the number to call, everybody, is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And we hope to hear from you as we are hearing from Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on.
In your opinion, how much does... chronic inflammation
in the development of cancer. So that's a complicated question. We know that in some instances, I'm just going to pick something that comes to mind. If you have an area, say, on the skin that's a non-healing chronic ulcerative condition, we know that that can increase your risk of the development of a scar cancer. In general, we think that an increased inflammatory state that's sustained can perhaps decrease your immune system's ability to fight off abnormal cell formation and perhaps lead to the development of some cancers.
Okay, well, thank you, Jim.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, bye. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and on to Charlie in Newburgh, New York. Okay, Charlie, you're on.
Hi, I was wondering, what can somebody who eats healthy and exercises regularly do to decrease their chances of getting cancer?
So certainly having a normal BMI, as you said, participating in regular exercise that increases your heart rate most days of the week, and eating a healthy, balanced diet, making sure to decrease the amount of red meat that's consumed. All of those are things that are very proactive and helpful in the development or the reduction in the risk of development of cancer. Obviously, factors outside of that that are environmental or hereditary, modifying those factors can be very difficult. But I certainly say from anyone's standpoint that those are very advantageous.
Can't choose your parents.
Right. or your friends sometimes.
Yeah, thanks a lot. All right, that was a great answer. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Only, well, no, actually, that was a lie. So let's go to Mark in Skodak. Mark, you're on.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, very well. How are you, Mark?
Okay, thank you for taking my call. 2005, I was diagnosed with metastatic squamous cell carcinoma advanced stage 4B in my lymph nodes in my neck and the base of my tongue. 21 months of treatment, radiation, and chemo. And I have since been clean, but I'm wondering what are the chances of it to recur?
So I would certainly say the further you're out from your diagnosis, the smaller the chance of a recurrence in the base of tongue and in your neck. Were you a smoker, may I ask?
I quit smoking in 1969, but I was informed that being a railroad engineer, diesel fumes causes squamous cell. Is that true?
I would say that that probably can contribute to the development. Smoking is probably the number one cause of head and neck cancers, particularly squamous cell cancers of the head and neck region. So as long as you're under the care of your primary care provider and you're coming in for regular examinations, I certainly think that's ideal surveillance. Are you still being followed by an oncologist as well?
Yes. Now it's down to once a year.
I think you're doing everything you're supposed to. Obviously, if you have any symptoms that you think are a little unusual and go outside of the normal aches and pains of getting older, you know, to reach out to your primary care provider or your oncologist. But I think you're doing all the right things.
So
congratulations.
Doctor, could you describe to us, because many of us don't know these things, what squamous cell cancer is? Is that cancer of the skin?
So that's a good question. Squamous cell carcinoma of the skin is a very type of squamous cell carcinoma. Squamous cells themselves are in different body parts. They are in the lining of your mouth, lining of your anal region, and along your skin. So any malignancy of those particular cells is a squamous cell cancer type.
Okay. Thank you very much for that great call. All right. Let's now go to Kim in Warwick, New York, but not before I give that number, 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Kim, you're on.
Hi, doctor. How are you today?
I'm very well, Kim. How are you?
I'm fine. The reason I'm calling, it was a year ago, I had stage 3 breast cancer. And I went through radiation and chemotherapy, and I'm on the Arimidex. Now, the reason I'm calling, what is the maintenance that I can do to keep cancer from coming back?
Things within your control are certainly to maintain a normal BMI, engage in exercise, again, exercise that increases your heart rate, participating in that a minimum of 30 minutes a day most days of the week. Healthy, balanced diet. Those are the things that you can control from your end, certainly.
And BMI is what?
Body mass index.
Okay.
And that's something you can...
Okay, and one more thing. What do you think of taking iodine for preventative?
I have not heard about taking iodine for a preventative agent for cancer.
So when I was a kid, they used to have iodine bottles, and there was always a skull and crossbones on the outside of it. Told you something.
So it's a heavy metal. So certainly used in large quantities, it can probably be dangerous. People certainly in around the World War II era were told to have iodine on hand because of potential fallout. So that was a concern of a different type.
And why is that?
So if there's nuclear fallout, if there's been a nuclear incident, you want to have an appropriate amount of iodine because the iodine will compete with whatever radioactivity is present that can affect your thyroid gland.
And don't some salts, doesn't some table salt have iodine?
So, doctor,
correct.
You don't recommend it?
I don't recommend it, and that's just because I don't have information to know that that affords you any benefit.
Thank you, Kim. Okay, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Nicholas in Schenectady. Okay, Nicholas, you're on. Nicholas.
Yes, doctor. What I'm wondering is, what is the backup for melanoma? What is the percent of the chance coming back?
That's an excellent question, but I think that's going to largely depend on the initial stage when you were diagnosed, what body part, and I mean by that, was this something involving the skin? Was it something involving the oral cavity?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Chances of getting in now are very good. We'll go to Alan Delmar. Alan Delmar, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Hi. Yes, my wife was treated for head and neck cancer. It's going on 9 years now. And she's recently developed unilateral hyperglossal palsy. And she had an MRI, which was unremarkable. So I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, that's a tough call. It would, in terms of the causation of this, if they're satisfied with imaging that this does not represent a recurrence, I guess the next question is this related to scar tissue formation involving the tongue muscle itself? You can certainly have some decreased muscle fitness after radiation therapy for a tongue cancer.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you,
doctor.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. So now your chances of getting in are excellent. There are two people waiting on the online. Hey, you know, we go quick. Well, let's go to Russell in Wappingers. Okay, Russell, you're on. Go.
Hello, doctor.
Good afternoon.
I have prostate cancer, and I was been on active surveillance for about 5 years. And at this point, my oncological urologist wanted me to go for a particular treatment. So I first checked about a prostatectomy, and two surgeons recommended against it and recommended for radiation treatment. So I'm now under the care of a radiation oncologist. And at this point, I'm taking bicalutamide, which is a testosterone blocker. And we'll be starting radiation therapy when my PSA gets below 1. The last time it was measured, it was about 8.5. And there are two types of radiation treatment that he is considering, and I'd just like to know what your opinion on is of each one. The one he seems leaning towards most now is sharp, stereotactic hypofractionated accelerated radiation therapy, and the other one is IGIMRT, image-guided intensity-modulated radiation therapy.
So not having the specifics of your particular stage of cancer and some of the other things
are
important.
Well, T3, he said.
T3. So I would tell you there are different modalities of therapy which you're already aware of. You're going to have to balance out the side effects with the benefits of either. Both are reasonable. It really does depend on the side effect profile and how that's going to fit for you.
Okay.
So that's the best we can do. Thank you. Okay. The telephone number here is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about seconds, and we'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, offering flexible social work graduate degrees, including a part-time Master of Social Work program combining on-campus and online coursework. adelphi.edu/MSW. Patricia Dalton-Fennell, founder of AHMA, and Lee Shapiro, MD, director of the Scleroderma Center and their research teams. Now conducting the Pathways to Scleroderma study, albanyhealthmanagement.com. Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, an inpatient rehabilitation and wellness center providing healing focusing on the body, mind, and spirit for those with various forms of addictions. VillaVeritas.org for inquiries. The Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world. WaldorfSaratoga.org. And Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends.
And we are back with the wonderful Dr. Tia Olds of New York Oncology Hematology. She's here with us to answer your question. She works on metastatic cancer using radiation. Is that right, Tia?
That's correct.
Yeah. Let me just say that there are a few people on the phone. We'll go and we'll see who comes first. And the first one to go first is Paul of Slingerland's. Paul of Slingerland's, you're on.
Hi, doctor. We have a history of colon cancer in our family, and it goes back a long way. Yale University recently did a study, and they found a GRIM1 mutation in our family, and the gene isn't previously included in the targeted test panels for hereditary polyposis, and we're trying to spread that word. But how do you get something like that included in the test panel?
That's an excellent question. I don't know the answer to that specific question. Certainly within our practice, we have professionals that actually perform genetic risk or hereditary risk assessments. And there are different panels, of course, as you mentioned, some that are very specific, some that include a list of abnormalities that have been associated with different hereditary conditions. I would suspect that over time, once the companies who make these assays are confronted with abnormalities that have not necessarily been listed in their panels, that they have to do further research to see how those things are categorized and how, in fact, they contribute to the development of different cancers.
Okay, thank you. The study, by the way, was published in 2016, Cambridge University Press. And although our family's name is not mentioned, the study discusses in medical terms what they found. So,
thanks a lot, Paul. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Tyrone in Port Jervis. All right. Tyrone, your turn.
Hello, Dr. Owen.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you. And you?
Good, thank you.
Very good. Just a brief question. Is there an established link between microwaving in plastic, such as Tupperware or Styrofoam, and an increased chance or risk of cancer?
So I'm aware that there is concern about some of the volatile compounds that are produced when you actually microwave certain plastics. Probably the most common is BPA, and the fact that that has been shown in some animal models to potentially lead it to the development of some malignancies.
And what is BPA, doctor?
Oh, that's a good question, and I don't remember what it stands
for. Is that the stuff on the frying pans?
No, that's different. BPA is actually a compound that's found in some plastics. It's actually found in the lining of some cans as well.
Okay.
And when it's actually heated or comes into contact with a liquid or substance that's heated, it actually transforms into BPA. It's actually something before that, and then it becomes BPA.
Yeah. So, Tyrone, you want to come back on this?
Yeah, I guess I'm not exactly sure what type of plastics are found in modern Tupperwares. I assume they're BPA free, since most companies are now aware of that risk.
I was going to say, I don't know if you can assume that. I think companies have made a huge effort to let you know that they're BPA free. So I would say if you don't see that listed, don't make the assumption that it's not present.
Isn't it a good idea not to put any plastic in the microwave, knowing what you know?
That's probably the best idea. I think it's probably more helpful to microwave in glass if you can.
Sure. Well, thank you.
Okay, and Styrofoam? What about like Styrofoam plates or whatever?
Coffee.
I would definitely say do not microwave in Styrofoam.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for the answer.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Okay, that was Tyrone. Okay, and now we're going to go, of all places, to Plainfield, Massachusetts. We're going to talk to Tim. Tim in Plainfield, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thank you for doing this. My partner's son was recently diagnosed with multiple myeloma, and I'm wondering what the prognosis is and if there are any experimental treatments.
So I deal with multiple myeloma generally after someone's presented with involvement of the bone that's painful and some other circumstances. Generally, my medical oncology colleagues are the ones who actually encounter this disease process at the beginning. It would largely depend on how he presented at the time of diagnosis and what stage he has. That has a lot to do with what treatments are being offered as well as his prognosis.
How do you identify bone cancer? How do you know when somebody has it?
Generally, the folks that come to you, I shouldn't say generally, but in some instances, it's because someone's developed anemia, a decreased amount of red blood cells for unclear reasons. Generally, the first thing you want to do is rule out a cause of bleeding. And if you can't find a source of bleeding, then you start to look at other things.
So now you go on the hunt for metastatic cancer. And if you know there's a primary site, then you decide to start looking for where it may have migrated to?
Exactly. If you find one at one location, then you want to see if there are other locations, because that's going to influence your choice of therapy and what you recommend.
And how do you do it? Total body scan?
Yeah, he presented with pneumonia. And so is the staging done through blood tests, or how's the staging done?
It's actually a few things. So it's going to be blood tests. It's going to be imaging, because all of those things are going to put together the stage for multiple myeloma.
Thank you, Tim. All right, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And now back home to Albany. All right, Albany, you're up, Frederick.
Yes, I was diagnosed with in 2000 with hypothyroid. So I've been on medication of Synthroid at the time. Now I'm on levothyroxine. But I still feel these symptoms, even though everything is good, the numbers are good. You know, the doctor says I'm doing good, this and that, but I still feel the symptoms of the thyroid being sluggish. You know, I'm kind of slow, you know, working and, you know, all that stuff, hair, skin, you know, all that stuff. So I was just kind of curious, what else should I be doing to kind of, like, promote my thyroid to get back in order?
So that's a good question. I would probably refer you back to your endocrinologist. That's going to be something that you guys have to have a very detailed discussion regarding, because that may not necessarily mean you need a change in the dose of your medication, but there could be some specific supplements that they recommend for you. But that's a little out of my wheelhouse. But I would definitely make the point to talk to your endocrinologist again.
I never went to one. It's always been through my family doctor. I always got to straighten it out, you know, straightened out with through the doctor. I don't think I ever been to an endocrinologist. So I can't tell you, you know, should I be going to one?
That might be an idea. Because if you guys have already put your heads together and you haven't really come up with anything in a more specific way of treatment, maybe it is time to see an endocrinologist. They may have some new insights.
Is there anything I should be looking, like symptoms, other symptoms that would, you know, I should be, you know, concerned about? Like swallowing, you know, I might be irritated, you know, with swallowing sometimes.
So it might not be a bad idea, and this is going to sound maybe a little bit simple, but write these things down. Write them down, have them in a list form, so when you actually go to meet that endocrinologist, you and the doctor can sit down and sort through what may be related to your thyroid, what may be caused by other things. I think that's the way you're going to get clarity.
Thank you, Frederick. Okay, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, lots of free phones. Actually, we have a waiting line of three, maybe four. Okay, here we go. Let's go to, let's go to Robert in Rensselaer County. Okay, Robert, your turn.
Good afternoon. I'm interested in an opinion from the doctor on issue of a benign polyp being discovered in an endoscopy that's right on the intestinal wall. And the opinion I've received from a gastroenterologist and surgeon is that it should be removed, but you know, it's so close to the intestinal wall, it couldn't be, you know, cut out, you know, normally that way. So should that be cut out, or should you be just hurry up and wait and watch over the years, or? Because I'm a little concerned about they may have to take up, you know, out a little section of the colon. So that's my concern
and
there.
And remember,
that
Dr. Olds is a radiologist. Is that right?
Radiation oncologist.
Yes, oncologist. And therefore, you forgot to list one other thing, which is that she could remove it by radiation.
So that actually,
yes, okay,
that would not be an indication for me to treat you with radiation, actually, because it's benign. But if you're mm-hmm. questioning what was recommended, you can always seek a second opinion to see if someone else has a different way that they may approach this.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry for paying close attention to the subject matter.
That's no, right. It's
thank
good.
You both.
You were good. Thank you.
Have a good afternoon.
Yeah. Okay. And now on to Carol and then Betty. We've got a Carol first in Lake Luzerne who's been waiting longer. Go ahead, Carol.
Hello. I've been diagnosed with MUGIS, which stands for monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. And I have to have my blood checked twice a year to see if I'm not proceeding to multiple myeloma. And I wondered if you knew how frequently it did proceed to that, and should I give blood having been diagnosed with this?
So I don't know the percentages for that. Again, that's a little bit out of my wheelhouse. That's something more for the medical oncologists and hematologists, actually, who can answer that for you. I would ask both those questions to your oncologist.
Okay, I missed the beginning of the show, and I didn't realize you were the radiologist. Sorry.
That's okay. Good luck.
Thanks, Carol. Okay, now on to Lori in Slingerlands. Okay, Lori, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I have a question about my brother-in-law. He's got stage 4 colon cancer, was diagnosed 5.5 years ago. He's gone through numerous treatments, 4 surgeries, liver resections because it went to his liver, and so on. So he just had a surgery about 2 months ago, and ever since post-op day number 1, he has not been able to eat, and he has now lost 35 pounds in muscle and fat. And my concern is that he has developed cachexia, and I want to know how do you test for that? And or can you just go by clinical presentation? And what are some good treatments for that?
Doctor, is that we heard the cachexia? Is that
cachexia?
Cachexia. What is that?
So he's losing weight.
Oh, I see.
And I'd assume he doesn't have an appetite as well.
That's correct.
Correct. So there are lots of causes to that. Has he gone back to see his oncologist?
No, we're trying to get him there. It's not been an easy road, so we're not there yet, but we're hoping to go with this week. He actually lives 4 hours away in the middle of nowhere, so.
Yeah, I think.
But anyway, he had some massive, large pleural effusions from this last surgery as well, and the fluid sat in there for a fair amount of time. So I don't know if that caused a lot of inflammation, causing the cachexia, or what are your thoughts as far as how to evaluate, diagnose it, and treat it?
I would think once he gets in with the oncologist, definitely going to be some additional testing because we need to see where he is in terms of his disease process. Certainly having a recurrence of the cancer itself can lead to cachexia. So I think that's what the oncologist is going to want to investigate as soon as possible.
Yeah, his CA is 0,
mm-hmm.
And he has no circulating tumor cells.
Mm-hmm.
So we're thinking it probably wasn't cancer. It was probably more due to some inflammatory process. So did you have any thoughts on what blood work you do and how to treat it?
I think that's a wide range, and I think you're going to have to wait until you see his medical oncologist to kind of figure that out. It could be something just as simple as getting him a medication that could stimulate his appetite.
Hey, Lori.
Right.
Thanks for the
right.
call, Lori. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Good luck.
Okay. Let's go now to Betty in Albany. All right, Betty, your turn.
Yes, doctor. I would like to know how effective is radiation for esophageal cancer, and are there long-term effects from the radiation?
So radiation treatment for esophageal cancer is usually in conjunction with chemotherapy, sometimes surgery as well. And we know that the folks that sometimes have the better outcome are the ones who can actually proceed with all three of those modalities. So radiation for esophageal cancer by itself is generally not used. Side effects are going to depend on where the cancer itself is located, whether it's in the top part of the esophagus, the middle, or the lower part.
The lower part.
So that's going to depend on how much the cancer is actually blocking food from passing. Sometimes the side effects can be quite minimal, but sometimes that can involve having more swallowing difficulties than you have prior to treatment. The tumors themselves can actually swell before they shrink in size.
I see. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Betty.
You're
welcome. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. 3 people holding, one of whom is Tim in East Nassau. Okay, Tim, you're on.
Hello, doctor.
Hello.
Hi. I have bladder cancer, and I was having it treated doing TURBT procedures, but I decided to have the radical cystectomy to take the bladder out, and then they realized that it had metastasized to my lymph nodes. So I'm currently receiving chemo treatments, but I've been having a lot of problems with my blood counts, and it doesn't seem to really be working out that well. I was wondering, are there other options that I might try, or what do you think my prognosis might be down the line?
I think that would largely depend on what other treatment options you and your oncologist discuss. That could simply be a waiting period of where you allow the counts to recover and you resume the same systemic treatment. The discussion may include changing treatments. Maybe you need a different regimen altogether. It may need to be a discussion about if there are clinical trials you're eligible for.
So basically, I have to wait to see if the cancer reappears somewhere else in my body before they can try something differently?
I don't think that's the case. I think it's going to be a matter of whether or not you get a recovery of your blood counts. Because before you can proceed with other treatments, that probably needs to normalize to some degree.
All right, because I've done 5 out of the 8 that I'm supposed to have. But like I said, I mean, it just drags on now because every time I go, either my platelets are low or my white blood cells are low. And it just seems not to be working. And I guess I feel kind of hopeless about the whole chemo process.
So I wouldn't abandon hope at this point. I would assume you haven't had any imaging since you actually started the chemotherapy. Is that correct?
Correct.
So you don't really have a sense of whether or not it's working. The effect on the blood counts is separate from your therapeutic effect. So try not to lose hope. See if there's going to be a recovery of if you have a recovery of your blood counts. If not, you guys may stop at the 5 out of 8 cycles, wait a month or so and reimage and see where you are with things, then make a decision whether or not to proceed with the same treatment or a different treatment.
Good luck, Tim.
Yep, good luck.
All right, thank you very much.
Take care.
Yep, bye-bye.
Bye.
Zachary, that's not hanging up. I don't know why. Anyway, we'll go now to... let's see here. Mike in Cornwall. All right, Mike in Cornwall. Go, Mike. Hey, Mike.
Yes, good afternoon. Excuse me. I have been, after a pneumonia that I had in the fall for quite a while, I have undergone various CAT scans of the lung. They supposedly saw, quote, this is an old term, a spot in one of the bronchia of the lung. CAT scan, high-resolution CAT scan, 2 very highly sophisticated PET scans. The question final is, can a cancer, and this is a putting it to the point where can it hide itself, or whatever, you know what I mean by this, that a PET scan, even the highest sophisticated ones, cannot pick it up?
Yes, you can.
That's
have...
That's my question.
You can have certain cancers that are not well detected by PET CT imaging. At the end of the day, you end up needing to get a tissue diagnosis of an abnormal area if those scans have not
That's
helped you.
That's what I thought.
Well, thank you very much.
In other words, a biopsy.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thanks, Mike. Okay, and now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll finish the show. We have about a third of the show to go, so if your name is Beth or Louise or Chris or Barbara, just hanging right in there.
Support for Vox Pop's Medical Monday on WAMC comes from Windhorse Naturopathic Clinic, Brattleboro, Vermont, offering naturopathic medicine, oxidative medicine, colon hydrotherapy, and acupuncture. Specializing in Lyme disease, now accepting new primary care patients. WindhorseNaturopathic.com. Ellis Medicine Cardiovascular Care, working to bring modern technology and treatment options to the Capital Region. Offering heart care in a community hospital setting, ellismedicine.org/heart. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to preserve freshwater resources that flow from the Adirondacks to New York's urban centers. nature.org/Adirondacks. And from Berkshire Country Day, an independent pre-K to 9 school, comprehensive curriculum and an emphasis on community. Now enrolling for fall 2018, intentional, independent, inspired, berkshirecountryday.org.
And And we are back, and we are delighted to be able to do the show. And thank you all for being with us. We're with Dr. T. Oles of New York Oncology Hematology. All right. So now we're going to proceed to Chris in Great Barrington. Hi, neighbor.
Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, my sister was diagnosed with a multiple endocrine neoplasia type 2, and she recently had her thyroid taken up. My question is there a role for radiation therapy in her disease, and what are the appropriate next steps that we should take as a family, both in the treatment of my sister as well as for ourselves, because I understand that this condition has some genetic component to it.
So this is not something that generally radiation oncologists have much involvement with. Indeed, there's a hereditary component to this. Has your sister undergone any genetic testing up to this point?
No, not yet.
Okay. That's probably the next thing that she's going to want to do. And whoever's taking care of her, if that practice offers any genetic testing, she should certainly have that conversation so that the rest of you and your family know how to approach this.
Okay. So do you know what the risk is for, since my sister's affected, do you know what the risk is for any other of my family members to be affected?
I don't. And with any hereditary condition, you're going to have different levels of penetrance, and that means how often the actual abnormality is expressed, and that's going to vary from generation to generation. So that really requires formal genetic testing.
Well, let's assume you get the genetic testing, and let's assume he does what you're recommending. Then what? In other words, what can happen then? Is there anything that his family could do preventive-wise?
So depending upon the results that could cause, cause a need for increased screening tests, increased screening examinations, maybe routine thyroid ultrasounds for people who are at increased risk of development of thyroid cancer as a consequence of this abnormality, maybe routine abdominal ultrasound or other testing to rule out adrenal cancers, which sometimes occurs with this.
Okay. Chris, thank you for calling.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Good luck with our sister.
Okay, let's go to... okay, the number here is 1-800-348-2551. You can certainly get in now. Let's go to Beth in Goshen. Beth in Goshen, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So, doctor, my question for you is, so my husband was diagnosed with stage 2 melanoma about 10 years ago and had regular PET scans. And then 2 years ago, he was diagnosed with stage 4 melanoma, and he had, you know, went through immunotherapy and multiple surgeries. And so, you know, his oncologist feels pretty good that it's not there anymore. But my question is, the recommendation from his oncologist is that he has CT scans as opposed to PET scans to confirm that he's clear and clean. And I just, I'm concerned about that because the protocol for 10 years was that he had to have PET scans. And now it seems like maybe it's because, you know, a PET scan might be more expensive and wouldn't be covered by insurance. And in my mind, that's how come they're doing the CT scans and not the PET scans. Do you have anything to say about that?
And before you do, Tia, would you explain what a PET scan is? That a brain scan?
So a PET scan is positron emission tomography, and it's usually paired with a low-resolution CT scan. PET imaging is a functional type of imaging. So you actually are consuming and being injected with a sugar molecule that's radioactively labeled, so that circulates throughout the body. There's going to be some normal uptake of that sugar molecule, and there can be abnormal uptake of that sugar molecule, and that can indicate a malignancy versus infection versus inflammation.
Yeah.
So that certainly can be helpful when we talk about melanoma. I think that's a balance between the imaging modalities. Often if there's something that's recurrent with regard to melanoma, It's probably something that can be seen on a contrasted CT scan, can be further characterized by a PET CT scan to give you some idea of activity, which could then direct whether or not that area should be biopsied. Honestly, in someone who's had recurrent melanoma, certainly stage 4 melanoma, your threshold is going to be very low for wanting to pursue a biopsy or further investigation of anything that's abnormal on imaging.
Yeah, because that's my concern. Like this second, you know, the recurrence of the melanoma, it was just hiding there, you know, and after he stopped having his regular PET scans, that's when this thing popped up. And so I'm just concerned that there's some, you know, little thing sitting there in wait, and that the CT scan is not really, you know, catching like a little hot spot that a PET scan may.
May I ask where the site was that you're mentioning that was unknown or that was hiding? Where was it?
It was subcutaneous on his back, mm-hmm. in a general proximity to where the original melanoma was.
Mm-hmm.
But it ended up involving his lung and some ribs and some stomach muscle and some other things.
So your concern is genuine. I think that's going to be a balance. Perhaps that may be alternating PET CT scans with CT scans to get more information.
So what do I do? What, like, language do I use with the oncologist? Because, you know, I go to every appointment with him, and she's just resistant to, and she's tremendous, but she's just been resistant to, you know, doing a PET scan. And I think that I do have a valid concern. And, is there some way to sort of, that you would think that she would be encouraged to pursue a PET scan?
So I would ask the question, why not get a PET CT scan now? What is the rationale behind getting it 6 months from now, 12 months from now? What would be the harm in alternating a diagnostic CT scan with a PET CT scan at different intervals, and see what her answer is? I'm sure she has a reason.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much,
yeah,
Beth.
Okay.
Good luck.
Okay. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. And so now on to Louise in Saratoga Springs. Okay, Louise, you're on.
Hi, doctor.
Hello.
I had radiation for breast cancer. It ended over a year ago, and ever since then, I have this funny symptom of warmth in my back. Like right now, I'm in my car, and it's like I'm on a heated seat. Or if I lay down at night, it's like I get all this warmth in my back. I just have been wondering if that could be related to the radiation staying in my body for a while or whatever.
Did you have lymph nodes treated?
I had some taken out.
Okay. Were there any...
Some muscle under the arm.
Were any of those lymph nodes positive for cancer?
No, they weren't.
Okay. So when they treated you with radiation, they just treated the breast? They didn't treat any lymph nodes around the collarbone or lymph nodes underneath the arm that you're aware of?
Yeah, under the arm they did. And it even went through to my back. Like I have that tan look even on my back.
So do you feel the sensation of warmth within that tan area?
It just seems like my whole upper back. I just, you know, it's always strange. I put my hand back there and I think, why does that feel like I'm on a heated seat? I just didn't know if it had anything to do with that, because I've read where it stays in your body for quite a while, radiation.
So when you receive external beam radiation therapy, the side effects with regard to skin and soft tissue, the acute ones tend to resolve within 3 to 4 weeks at most. Certainly some things can be long-term. But I would expect those to be confined to the area that received the radiation treatment. This sounds like more of a diffuse process against or across both sides of your back, and that wouldn't have been included within the radiation field. So I don't have a good explanation for you.
Okay. Well, yeah, I just wondered pretty much then it's probably not related to that. That's what I wondered.
Yeah.
And I thank you so much for your answer.
You're welcome. Have a great
Thanks,
day.
Thanks, Louise. Okay. Now we're going to go on to Barbara in Leverett, Massachusetts. And by the way, if you want to try, we might be able to get your call in too. Barbara in Leverett on line 6. Barbara, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi.
And I apologize for such a simple question, but I after listening to all this, I'm wondering exactly how radiation works.
Just in general? In general? With
yep.
Okay. So in general, the largest way that radiation therapy affects cancer cells is its ability to sterilize them. So if something's alive and it can't make more of itself, it means over time, those numbers of cells are just going to die off and not be replaced. A very small percentage of cancers.
So it kills them.
Yes. Not a direct kind of kill the way you would think of, but again, if you can't make more of yourself, you just start to die off and you're not replaced.
Right. So, but cancer cells are just cells that are those that are have that lack differentiation, the ones that have already changed.
Correct.
So how do you discern the difference?
How do you discern cancer from non-cancerous cells?
Yeah, I mean, you know, how do you determine what to pulverize? Maybe that's not the right term.
How does radiation distinguish between cancerous and non-cancerous cells?
How do you determine the dosage?
Oh, so that's going to be based on experience. There have certainly been some dose response studies that have been done historically, but a lot of this is based on what has worked in the past for different malignancies, so we have some sense of that. Different cancer types can be more resistant to radiation therapy, which would imply that you need a larger dose, larger total dose, perhaps a larger dose per treatment. Energy.
I see.
I was just going to say that radiation is energy. So.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that radiation itself is just energy. How you actually get to distinguish?
But it can cause its own problems. Correct.
Certainly, you can have toxicity from the radiation therapy itself, yes. And you do have a small percentage of cancer that can actually be caused by radiation therapy and radiation exposure.
And what are those?
Oh, that's a long list of different types of cancers. But again, that's going to be dependent upon the dose of radiation, the area in which the radiation was delivered, and the actual individual that received the radiation. If there are already hereditary genetic components in play, these people can be more susceptible to the development of secondary cancers.
Barbara, got to go.
I was wondering, like, so for breast cancer, can it cause a increased migration to other parts of the body?
Can the radiation therapy cause the cancer to spread to other parts of the body? Is that the question?
In the long term.
No, but the radiation itself can lead to a secondary cancer. Those rates are low, but that can happen.
And thank you so much, Barbara. Okay, we have time for one or two more. And if you want to call now, you'll probably get in. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We go to Joshua in Walden. Okay, Joshua, you're on. Joshua. Whoa. Joshua is gone. Don't ask me what happened. Let's go to, he's back. All right, on line number two, he's back. So we'll try to take him first. Okay, Joshua, are you there? Joshua.
Yes, Joshua from Walden.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, my question was, is there any sort of signs, physical sensations that you could potentially assess within certain parts of your body when a cancer is growing? Something like could that affect a different muscular skeletal system or something like that would bring noticeable physical discomfort?
So if you're pain in your arm or your leg, for example, or your buttocks.
So I think that introduces a lot of potentials. Certainly that can be related to a tumor, but it certainly can be caused by other things as well. So it's kind of a long laundry list on the initial assessment if you just have something that feels uncomfortable in the muscle system or the bony parts of your body.
So what you would go to your doctor, right?
And that's the first step.
Thank you, Joshua. Okay, let's go to now, let's see here, Linda in Troy. All right, Linda in Troy, you're on.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, good. Good. Hi. Yeah, you know, I just happened to be listening to the radio, and this is a subject that's very high in my life. In 2003, I was diagnosed with stage 3C uterine cancer. So I had surgery, radiation, and then in 2004, I completed the radiation treatments. I had chemo. I had surgery, chemo, and then in 2004, I had external beam radiation. And I got sick immediately. You know, the doctor never told me that I was going to get sick, and I got sick immediately. Well, now, all this time later, and I've been diagnosed with radiation enteritis. I have malabsorption. I was in the hospital a year ago. I'd lost 50 pounds in 1 year. My intestines just stopped working because
they've been cooked
by radiation.
Linda, we're running out of time. I mean it.
I just set the stage. So I do have a question. Now, do you have any opinion about how to treat radiation enteritis? And has anything been done in your field to prevent this kind of damage to healthy, necessary cells?
So I am sorry to hear that happened. There's some drugs that have been used with varying degrees of success, like Trentel, Pitoxafilin. Radiation enteritis to that degree is fairly uncommon, but it's going to be dose dependent. It's going to depend on how much bowel was actually treated, and there are individual factors that are hard to account for. So you could just unfortunately be one of the unlucky people that developed this condition.
Thank you, Linda. Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay. So we are about out of time. I wanted to apologize to Rob in Chicopee, to Mary Jane in Pittsfield. Rob has a swollen lymph node, and he wanted to know doctor and treatment. You want to do that really quickly?
So swollen lymph nodes, certainly. Hopefully you've seen your primary care provider, maybe seen an ear, nose, and throat specialist, because you're going to want to rule out infection, inflammation, versus something more serious like a malignancy.
Okay, Mary Jane in Pittsfield. How successful is gamma knife radiation for tumors in dura?
So that's going to depend on whether or not you've already had a surgery to try to remove whatever tumor's there. I'm assuming that's probably a meningioma. And it's going to depend on the grade of the type of tumor that was there.
And Rachel in Harlington wants to know the best treatment for stage 4 prostate cancer.
That's going to be a discussion between you and the oncologist.
Okay, I gotta go. Thank you all for calling. We are out of time. Support for Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Beloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.